Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we have news about a landmark settlement in a case filed by the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties against the federal government affirming rights of immigrants in detention. Then we'll have updates on several close local races with unofficial results from the primary election, including flips since election night in two key assembly races and the outcome of a very close high school bond measure. More stormy weather is headed our way, and we'll have details later on today. A missing hiker has been found safe thanks to the efforts of the Sheriff's Volunteer Search and Rescue Team. An appellate court has revived a lawsuit seeking to stop the Boulder Brush substation after the court found a lower court erred in throwing out the case. We'll tell you why on our show today. The American Heart Association is warning dieters of a dramatic rise in heart-related deaths among people following a popular diet that limits eating to an 8-hour period each day. San Diego State University's former president, Stephen Weber, has died, and we'll have a look back at his tenure on our show today. An elderly man has died in a house fire in Santee despite valiant efforts by firefighters. And a gun buyback event hosted by the Sheriff's Department in Lemon Grove proved successful in getting 184 guns off the streets. Our newsmaker interviews today are with two activists from La Mesa, Janet Castaños and Jean Carpenter. We'll be talking about limits on free speech and public access after the La Mesa City Council voted to ban remote public comments. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
A federal judge has approved a settlement in a long-running class action lawsuit affirming the constitutional due process rights of people in immigration custody in San Diego and Imperial Counties. The suit was filed by the ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties and several law firms on behalf of immigrant plaintiffs. The case, Cancino-Casteller v. Mayorkas, filed in March 2017, challenged systemic delays in processing people arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, including Border Patrol. The settlement with federal government requires that immigration agencies will provide class members with written notice in multiple languages, informing them of their right to a prompt first appearance. Those who wish to see a judge promptly will have a first appearance within 11 days of entering ICE custody. Class members already residing in the U.S. who are arrested by Border Patrol will be processed out of Border Patrol custody within 3 days, either to ICE custody or released. Class members who indicate on the processing forms that they would like a bond hearing will receive one at the soonest available date. In every other form of custody, when the government arrests someone, there is a constitutional obligation to begin court proceedings before a judge promptly. This due process protection ensures that the government does not make people disappear into its custody and that those arrested are promptly made aware of their rights. Prior to this lawsuit victory, the federal government asserted those in immigration custody were not entitled to these protections. As a result, people arrested by U.S. immigration agencies, many of whom reside in our local communities, routinely endured weeks and sometimes months in harsh immigration detention conditions. While waiting prolonged periods of time to see a judge, they were separated from their loved ones and unable to attend their jobs, education, and families. Because the federal government does not provide attorneys to people in immigration custody, many were unable to seek release or begin their case until their first hearing. In San Diego and Imperial Counties, immigration agencies have the capacity to incarcerate more than 2,000 people every day in ICE immigration jails, Border Patrol stations. Jose Cancino Castellar was one of the plaintiffs in the case. He says, "ICE arrested me when I was 18, and it was so hard not to see my parents or my brother and sister for a month. I was scared at the time, not knowing what was going on with my case or if I would be released, but once I saw a judge, I was released and able to return to them." He adds, "That first hearing is so important. I am proud I was able to help so that other people won't have to go through what I went through." Ifaun Cobb, Deputy Legal Director for the ACLU Foundation in San Diego says, "We celebrate that the court honored the constitutional principles we hold dear and that members of our communities will not be held for prolonged periods without seeing a judge. We will continue to fight to ensure that the right of due process extends to all people, including newly arrived people seeking asylum who are not immediately covered by this decision." Attorney Alex Gelberg from the law firm Fish & Richardson PC says, "Prolonged immigration detention has disastrous effects by imposing tremendous hardship on detainees and their families. The settlement achieves important protections for this vulnerable class. I am extremely proud that Fish's pro bono program supported the case from the outset and throughout the years, making it possible to obtain the much needed relief." Len Simon of the law offices of Leonard B. Simon also represented plaintiffs in the case. He concludes, "I am very pleased to have been part of this lengthy and successful effort to further due process rights for immigrants to the U.S. and this country that prides itself on giving everyone his or her timely day in court." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Danita Ramirez.
The San Diego County Registrar of Voters has released unofficial results from the primary election. Final results will be certified by 5 p.m. on April 4th. The only ballots not yet counted countywide are about 3,700 mail-in ballots returned with a missing or non-matching signature. Those voters were mailed letters, giving them until April 2nd to provide signatures. Once verified, these cured ballots will then be tallied. It's unclear just how many of those ballots will be cured and counted, and how many are in any given district. Here's an update on some close races in East County, where flips in two key assembly races since election night appear to have held. In the 79th Assembly District, La Mesa Councilman Colin Parent has 39% of the vote, solidly in first place. Still vying to advance to the November runoffs are educator Lachey Sharp Collins, who's currently in second place with 16,820 votes, or about 30%, and Lemon Grove Mayor Raquel Vasquez is close behind, trailing by only 111 votes. As for the 75th Assembly race, the top two runoff will be between two Republicans. Carl DeMaio has just over 54,000 votes, finishing first. In second place is Andrew Hayes, with just over 23,000 votes, above Democrat Kevin Juza, who has 22,996 votes, a margin of just 672 votes separating Hayes and Juza. In the Mountain Empire Unified School District, the facilities bond Measure B appears to have been narrowly defeated, with 1,614 no votes and 1,532 yes votes. These close races are a good reminder that every vote counts. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Zaravon with the weather report. A Pacific storm is pushing a cold front across Southern California. The National Weather Service forecast predicts rain and gusty winds this weekend, starting Saturday through Monday, and up to a half inch of rain across the coastal and inland areas, but less than a quarter inch in the deserts. Snow is forecasted for San Diego County's mountain areas, so use caution when driving.
An all-night search by the Sheriff's Volunteer Search and Rescue Unit has safely located a man who had been missing for over 14 hours in Sycamore Canyon Preserve. The search began after the 57-year-old man failed to return from a hike in Sycamore Canyon on March 19th. He had begun his hike at 9 a.m., and his family reported him missing at 1 p.m. A sheriff's command post was established at the Sycamore Canyon County Preserve, which includes portions of Poway and Lakeside. Volunteers with the Sheriff's Search and Rescue Unit searched the area with the assistance of the Sheriff's Astrea helicopter throughout the night. The next morning around 3 a.m., the man was found alive on one of the hiking trails in Sycamore Canyon. He was transported to a local hospital, and his family was notified. The Sheriff's Department thanks the all-volunteer search and rescue team, which performs wilderness and urban rescues, as well as searches for missing and at-risk persons. Teams are available 24 hours per day to respond to local, state, and federal agency requests. To learn more or become a volunteer, visit sdsheriff.net and choose the I Want To tab at the top, which has a list of volunteer opportunities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
An appellate court has found that a trial court has wrongfully dismissed a lawsuit against San Diego County. The suit challenges supervisor's approval of the TerraGen Boulder Bush electrical substation in rural East County. The substation would connect TerraGen Campo Wind Project on Campo Tribal Land. Earlier plans called for the substation to also connect with the proposed Torrey Wind Project in Campo. TerraGen has since withdrawn its application for that project after the deadline expired. The nonprofit group Backcountry Against Dumps, along with ranch owners Ed and Donna Tisdale, filed a lawsuit in 2021. But the Campo Tribe filed a motion asking that the suit be dismissed on grounds of sovereign immunity, and the Superior Court granted that motion. Now on March 13th, the Court of Appeal has issued a ruling ordering the Superior Court to vacate its earlier judgment of the dismissal and allow the trial to proceed. Donna Tisdale says, "The bottom line is that Boulder Bush substation is proposed for private land where sovereign immunity does not apply. Big energy projects can help tribes power their reservations and potentially profit by selling excess energy. Campo's tribal leaders support the project, though some Cabo tribal members have opposed due to its concerns over the giant wind turbines near their homes, generating not only electricity, but also noise and potential fire hazard, since existing turbines on Campo land have sparked multiple fires." Back County Against Dumps and the Tisdales argued that the project's environmental impact report violated the California Environmental Quality Act by failing to analyze impacts on Golden Eagle's underground resources and wildfire risk, among other things. They also contended that the project in rural Campo would violate the county's general plan on zoning ordinance. The appellate court, in reversing the dismissal of the case, cited a need to assure fairness and equality for all parties. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Zaravan Ali. An appellate court has found that a trial court has wrongfully dismissed a lawsuit against San Diego County. The suit challenges supervisor's approval of the TerraGen Boulder Bush electrical substation in rural East County. The substation would connect TerraGen Campo Wind Project on Campo Tribal Land. Earlier plans called for the substation to also connect with the proposed Torrey Wind Project in Campo. TerraGen has since withdrawn its application for that project after the deadline expired. The nonprofit group Backcountry Against Dumps, along with ranch owners Ed and Donna Tisdale, filed a lawsuit in 2021. But the Campo Tribe filed a motion asking that the suit be dismissed on grounds of sovereign immunity, and the Superior Court granted that motion. Now on March 13th, the Court of Appeal has issued a ruling ordering the Superior Court to vacate its earlier judgment of the dismissal and allow the trial to proceed. Donna Tisdale says, "The bottom line is that Boulder Bush substation is proposed for private land where sovereign immunity does not apply. Big energy projects can help tribes power their reservations and potentially profit by selling excess energy. Campo's tribal leaders support the project, though some Cabo tribal members have opposed due to its concerns over the giant wind turbines near their homes, generating not only electricity, but also noise and potential fire hazard, since existing turbines on Campo land have sparked multiple fires." Back County Against Dumps and the Tisdales argued that the project's environmental impact report violated the California Environmental Quality Act by failing to analyze impacts on Golden Eagle's underground resources and wildfire risk, among other things. They also contended that the project in rural Campo would violate the county's general plan on zoning ordinance. The appellate court, in reversing the dismissal of the case, cited a need to assure fairness and equality for all parties. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Zaravan Ali.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Former San Diego State University President Stephen Weber has died. Weber served as president at SDSU for 15 years until retiring in 2011. Born on St. Patrick's Day in 1942 in Boston, Weber also died on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, at age 82, surrounded by his family at his home in New Jersey. As SDSU president, Weber's leadership helped transform SDSU into one of the nation's top universities, leading the nation in improved graduate graduation rates. He built strong ties with the San Diego community, raised academic standards, and diversified the campus. Weber also pioneered programs to help military veterans and low-income first-generation college students enter SDSU. His wife, Susan, was an essential ally in his work. In 2015, the SDSU College for Honors Students was renamed the Susan and Stephen Weber Honors College. Weber also served on the boards of the Perez Center for Peace and Innovation, the NCAA Executive Committee, and the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, which he chaired in 2002. When Weber retired in 2011, he and Susan relocated to Maine, living in the vacation home they built at the start of his career. Weber continued to pursue his passions, including hiking and kayaking. He served as chairman of the board of AVID, which trains 85,000 educators annually. Susan died of pulmonary fibrosis in 2014. 2 years later, Stephen Weber met Stephanie Ralph, bringing their extended families together, first in Maine, then in Williamsburg, Virginia, and finally in Jersey City, New Jersey. In October of 2021, Weber was diagnosed with ALS, a neurodegenerative disease. He participated in trials to advance the medical understanding of ALS. In spite of his physical decline, he published a collection of essays titled Reflections in the Mirror of Life in 2023. He continued supporting charities and cheered on his beloved SDSU Aztec sports teams to the very end. A statement from San Diego State University remembers Weber as a lifelong advocate and dedicated servant to education and the growth of the human spirit. He is loved and missed by family, friends, colleagues, and students who appreciate his lasting impact. Donations in his memory can be made to the President Stephen Weber Fund for Excellence at SDSU. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Ramirez.
An elderly man has died at a fire in his home on Woodside Avenue in Santee. Shortly before 2:30 a.m. on March 11th, a neighbor reported seeing smoke and flames coming from the home. The Santee Fire Department and deputies from the Sheriff's Santee Station arrived within minutes and found the home fully engulfed in flames. According to Detective Dan Wilson, a man living at the home was standing outside and advised that his father might still be inside. While the fire was still burning, Santee firefighters entered the home and quickly began looking for the man's father. They found him in a bedroom. Unfortunately, he was severely burned and was pronounced dead at the scene. Detectives from the Sheriff's Bomb and Arson Unit were called into the scene to investigate the origins and cause of the fire, which was near the rear of the home. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. However, the fire does not appear to be suspicious, according to Detective Wilson. The identity of the victim has not yet been released. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Zara Von Ali.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The San Diego County Sheriff's Department teamed up with its law enforcement partners to help get unwanted weapons off of our streets through a gun safety event in Lemon Grove on March 4th. A total of 184 unwanted firearms were turned in by the public during the event at the First Baptist Church on Lemon Grove. Individuals received $100 gift cards for handguns, rifles, and shotguns, or a $200 gift card for assault weapons and ghost guns. Free cable locks and gun safety lock boxes were also given out to people looking to secure firearms kept in their homes. All weapons collected will be processed. Any firearms found to have been involved in a crime will be referred to the appropriate law enforcement agency. If any guns are found to be stolen, the original owners will be contacted. All remaining weapons will be destroyed with accordance to the law. If you missed this event, you can always turn in unwanted weapons at any sheriff's station or substation. For your safety, keep the gun in the trunk of your car and await further instructions from a deputy. You can also call the sheriff's non-emergency line at 858-565-5200. One more time, that's 858-565-5200. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, I'm Zara Von Ali.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, I am delighted to have two very special guests, both activists in La Mesa, Janet Castaños and Jean Carpentu, and they're here to talk about concerns over public access and free speech issues in La Mesa. Janet earned her PhD in education administration and policy studies, and she's been active in East San Diego leadership for over 40 years. She's the retired Dean of Humanities and Social Behavioral Sciences and the former acting vice president of academic affairs for the Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District. Janet was also one of the original task force members that formed La Mesa's Community Police Oversight Board, where she served as chair and vice chair. She also serves as president of La Mesa Conversations and is on the steering committee for Keep La Mesa Beautiful. And she has facilitated San Diego's Resident Leadership Academy, which empowers residents to speak out and advocate for changes in their community. That's an impressive resume, Janet.
Thank you. I've been busy.
Okay. And Gene has been a busy guy, too. He is one of the founding members of the La Mesa Conversations Group, keeping people abreast about all those important issues going on around town. He ran the Fresh Start Breakfast at La Mesa First United Methodist Church for 2 years with help from Bonnie Baranoff and others. He's also a former board member of the La Mesa Foothills Democratic Club, and he currently serves on the steering committee as a member of Keep La Mesa Beautiful. In addition, Jean has been a very valued community volunteer with East County Magazine. So, Jean, welcome to the show, and thanks for all that you do.
Thank you, Miriam.
So, today we're here to talk about a very important issue that affects everyone in La Mesa. As background, during a city council meeting in mid-February, February 7th, I think it was?
13th.
Sorry, February 13th. A number of remote participants called in, unfortunately, with anti-Semitic comments and some really vile hate speech. And at the very next meeting, the city council voted 4-1 with Jack Shue against to end remote comments by the public, although the official reason that was given was that the pandemic was over. But it was pretty clear from some of the discussions that some of these concerns were centered around not wanting, you know, this offensive speech to go on. So I wonder if each of you can start by telling me why you're concerned about the council banning remote participation completely.
Yeah, basically it was just what I would call a knee-jerk reaction. It was a simple way to just handle the problem. They didn't address the hate speech. They didn't have a public comment about it other than what the lawyer said, you know, what's legal in terms of free speech.
Yeah, I want to interject for just a moment. I should have given that as background. The when all this was going on, the council did ask the lawyer, to comment on it. And the lawyer explained to the public that, you know, while many find this offensive, they could not shut down the anti-Semitic speakers because that would violate the Constitution and could subject the city actually to a lawsuit if they did that. So it was either, you know, ban everything or ban nothing, essentially. But
right.
Of course, it doesn't ban people from still showing up in person and doing the same thing, only those calling in remotely.
Yeah, so the concern of the community was, we had built greater community activity, greater engagement in our city council with the Zoom and call-in options, because more and more people, if they were homesick with children, or if they had childcare or elder care issues, or if they were sick themselves, they could stay home and still comment on items coming before the board. So it was really frustrating to think that without even taking the time to look at a variety of options that are used by the City of San Diego, City Council, or the Board of Supervisors, how can we address the hate speech without completely cutting off access to many people with accessibility issues?
Yeah.
And that's what's frustrating, is they didn't make an attempt to even look at the various options that are available to them.
And we'll talk about that in a minute after we hear from Jean, but I did first want to ask you, does this affect more than the city council? Does it affect things like, you know, the Planning Commission or the Police Oversight Commission, any of the others that may videotape their meetings and take and in the past have taken remote comments.
Yes, it affects all boards and commissions for the city of La Mesa. There are no remote comments allowed. You have to physically be there if you want to make a public comment about anything on the agenda.
Wow. So if you've got COVID, or if you've got little crying babies, you just have to bring them along, or if you're sick, I guess you either come infect everybody or you just stay home and lose your voice. That's right. That's, you know, a shame. I really think one of the positive things that came out of COVID has been the ability for all kinds of people to participate wherever you are. If you're on vacation, if you're working and you can't afford to, you know, to take the night off to go to the meeting, you know, as well as all the things you mentioned. But Gene, can you share what some of your concerns are about this?
Yes. One of them is on the lighter side. I was interviewed at the meeting where I believe it was KUSI, mm-hmm. and I got a couple of minutes in with them. But the only thing that after they finished editing, and it's a lot different. I want to compliment your venue here, is that this is going to be a complete interview rather than whatever KUSI or Fox or whoever decides to put in there or not, because they mentioned me saying was how hateful and ugly because I was actually physically at that meeting. Mm-hmm. And then the follow-up meeting, all they mentioned was that I was appalled, but they didn't add that I really felt like we're taking the wrong path if we're going to stop remote public comments altogether, because you fight hate speech by more speech, not shutting the system down. And by the way, the city council isn't affected at all by remote comments being taken away. It makes their meeting move a little bit better and quicker.
You're not hearing from as many people, you know. Yeah. But that might make it smoother, but it seems to me that it's really cutting out a lot of important voices, particularly those that may have been marginalized in the past, you know, low-income folks that might have to work, or new moms, all these different things, disabled people. How about somebody who doesn't have transportation, perhaps, who can't afford an Uber to get to the meeting? I think one of the few good things that came out of the pandemic was remote participation.
Sure. And the other thing, if I might add, Megan Weigelman, our city clerk, had made a comment about it being no longer necessary due to post-COVID. But before that, she would read public comments. You're limited to 500 words. And normally you get 3 minutes. Some people can get a lot in, but...
So are they going to go back to doing that now?
Well, we don't know. And that's part of the reason we wanted to meet with you. But Megan would read public comments that she received, and she's a speed reader. And she reads it so there's no nuance break. It's just reading it as fast as she can. And I don't mean to criticize Megan, but it's a little different when it's personal and somebody takes the time to write in.
Well, it is. And then also she would have to read maybe things that might be extremely offensive if people are, you know.
Sure. Well, she would have the opportunity to edit that at that point. But yeah, I understand. And it's a lot of work.
And there's censorship concerns, you know. So
it's a lot of work for her to manage call in remotely, too.
I will say that of all of the other public boards and commissions that we cover, which is an awful lot of them in East County, the four city councils, several school boards, other boards, of the ones which have video, which is most of them, all the major boards, I take that back, Lemon Grove does not, but all of the ones that have live video of the meetings that people can access, they do allow remote comments. And so I'm very surprised, you know, that La Mesa hasn't done this. And I will say I've seen examples other places, even before COVID, of some very offensive speech. And, you know, they're not the first council to wrestle with this issue where someone comes up and says something obnoxious or insulting, but they just kind of let it be. And typically it doesn't last. It might go on for a meeting or two, and eventually people get tired and go away and quit doing it. So it seems like they didn't even really give it time to see if that would happen. But Janet, I want to go back to what you said about other options short of just banning everybody from remote participation. What else do you believe they might have been able to consider?
Well, I made a series of recommendations at the February 27th City Council meeting, mm-hmm. right as they voted to ban all public comments. And I made a series of recommendations that Colin Parent said they would look into and review. Well, they haven't, and they still haven't. Their ad hoc subcommittee has not gotten back to me or returned my calls, which is really disheartening. But my recommendations to them were to have all speakers provide their first and last names, their city of residence, and the topic, just like we do when we're physically at the meetings. Make sure that Zoom callers mm-hmm. Have to provide the same information mm-hmm. and have them speak on camera, because we're physically there. Have them speak on camera.
I have a question about those two, because I know years ago I covered a meeting where someone wanted to be anonymous. It was in person, but they didn't want to have to give their name. It was testimony about Blackwater, you know, wanting to build a training camp. And this woman said, no, I'm afraid these are guys that build bombs in Iraq, and I don't want them to know who I am. And it went to county council, and county council said, you cannot make someone give their name in public testimony. If they wish to remain anonymous, you have to let them do that. So I'm not sure about that. And yeah. The other issue with the on-camera, there are some boards that tried it, and it sounds like a great idea, but there was Zoom bombing that went on, you know, where people would put up pornography and things, or, you know, naughty words on camera.
On the camera.
So it's sort of a, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
A double-edged sword a bit. But what are the other suggestions?
Well, the order of speakers can be, and let me just preface this with saying that the first 15 minutes of public comments that are not agenda items, you know, just open public comments about anything, mm-hmm. You can order your speakers and you can limit the time on that. And then you can have the rest of the speakers speak at the end of the meeting. I'm recommending that they order the speakers by first Mesa residents who are present, mm-hmm. secondly by non-residents who are present, third by La Mesa residents who call in, and last by non-residents who call in. And that way, if the 15-minute time segment is up by, you know, after several speakers have spoken, the rest of them can speak, but it would be at the end of the meeting. And typically, Zoom bombers want an audience. And if at the end of the meeting, everyone pretty much has left the chamber, then they...
Seems like a very practical solution.
Yeah.
And you can ask them for their names. You can't require it, but you can ask it.
And so, asking for names, and you can't require it. That's good to know. Mm-hmm. But speakers must stay within their topic as they list on the speaker card. So mm-hmm. they identify a topic. They need to stay within that topic. If they start going off on, you know, some rant, then you have to... Mm-hmm. Tell them you can finish your comment at the end of the meeting, but right now you've completed what you wanted to say on that topic. To maintain that 15 minutes at the beginning of the meeting, that's all we're allotting for general
comment. A good idea. And of course, they can always, you know, amend that if they see there's a whole slew of people that they really want to hear from on a very important topic. You know, they can always say we're going to allow more than 15 minutes this time if everybody agrees.
Exactly.
I might add that we're talking about general comments that are usually speakers are given the opportunity at the beginning of beginning of the meeting, and mm-hmm. it's about things that are non-agendized.
Right, like we want you to talk about, you know, put storm drains on the agenda or something. Yeah, exactly. Or fix the pothole on my street or something. But that wouldn't address, I suppose, agendized items if somebody actually were speaking on something relevant. I'm thinking, for example, in Lemon Grove, when they were considering a Gaza ceasefire resolution, if someone is calling in there with, you know, remarks about Gazans or Israelis or something, they would certainly, you know, that would be a hot topic at least.
But it needs to be... focus on the topic, and if they start getting into hate speech, then they can be invited to finish at the end of the meeting. So I think that, sticking to the comments is kind of crucial.
Yeah, and you certainly can't just do it off topic. You can't say, I'm going to talk about potholes or storm drains and start off on some racist or anti-Semitic or anti-LGBTQ rant, you know.
And to be clear, if a topic is agendized and someone wants to call in remotely, they have to stick to that topic. Am I correct? Because otherwise, so why are we also taking away the right for someone to remotely call in on an agendized topic? And it's, I think there's a distinction, isn't there, that would allow the city council to cut off it because.
Oh, good point. You mean, in other words, if they were firm about banning the general public comments.
Correct.
Would they at least lift the ban on comments for agendized items? Although that might confuse people, but I suppose that is, you know.
I don't think it's that confusing, really. I mean.
Yeah. What are other communities members saying about this? Has this been discussed in any groups that you guys are involved in? And if so, what are you hearing out there? Do people care?
People do care, and especially when we start to look at the statistics that make up the city of La Mesa, 15% of our La Mesa residents are seniors. So they're either people who maybe are at home taking care of an elderly parent or elderly spouse, but 15% are seniors. 15% of the residents have some type of disability, and then almost 30% are households with young children. So just like we saw at our last city council meeting for La Mesa, a young father brought his infant and two-year-old and four-year-old into the chamber, and they were acting as children do, and he was trying to speak, and the two-year-old was saying, dada, 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 nonstop.
So the whole audience shows up with screaming babies.
And so he was trying to...
You really want those folks at home calling him?
Exactly. So, you know, he was trying to demonstrate how challenging it is for him to do this. His wife works at night, and so he made an effort to, you know, make it clear what it's like. So when 50% of our population or 50% or greater have accessibility issues and you're cutting them off for convenience sake, is that right? I don't think it is right. I don't think it's democratic. I don't think it enhances community engagement.
Yeah, I agree. And I will say we've certainly seen other boards have to put up with stuff that, you know, is offensive, frankly. During COVID, the supervisors were called every name under the book by the kind of anti-mask or anti-COVID crowd, but they didn't, you know, unless it dissolved into an actual threat, they let them have their say. We saw the same, I remember in El Cajon, when someone came up and was using profanities, and, you know, he was asked to clean it up because there might be children, you know, watching, but he didn't. And after consultation with their city attorney, they said, no, they apologized to the audience, but said, you know, we're going to take a short break. And if you don't want to hear this, you know, you may want to take the kids outside, but we do have to allow this person to speak. So they dealt with it. But again, it wasn't a pervasive thing. I want to read a little bit about what Jack Hsu had to say, who was the lone dissenting vote. He was the only one to vote against this. He said that in terms of freedom of speech and public testimony, it's a hard issue at times and that it's hard to stomach hearing hate speech, but that we should not be intimidated or fear what may happen in the future with regards to public testimony. And he also said, I thought this was a very good point, council members have the ability to use remote access to participate in council meetings, you know, if they're traveling or sick. The public should be given the same ability to participate in our forum, in our council meetings remotely. So, for what that's worth. You know, are they going to ban council members from calling in?
I know. I mentioned that too at the last city council meeting, that the city council members have the option to participate remotely. They can vote, they can Zoom in, they can participate in the discussion. And if they are engaging in remote, leadership, then the community is allowed to, by law, also engage remotely with comments. But we don't know to the last minute if they're going to be zooming in for their city council role. We yeah. don't know that, and we have to assume that they're all going to physically be there. And that just puts us all at a disadvantage. And maybe that's the idea, is put the community at a disadvantage so that we don't have to hear from them. I don't know. I mean, I get really frustrated with that as well. It's like, why do they have all the rights and we don't? I don't know.
Absolutely. Lost my train of thought here. Give me a second.
Yeah.
I know what I was going to ask. We have seen in La Mesa that this is a council that has been known to listen to the public and occasionally change its stance, notably recently with the electronic billboards, where they voted for it, and then they ultimately, well, first they voted against it, then they voted for it, and then after there was a petition put up with a bunch of signatures, and you know, we did a report about safety problems in the area, a lot of accidents where they were talking about putting them up, the people who had actually proposed it withdrew it and said, you know, we want to redo the vote and decide this is not the right time for La Mesa to consider electronic billboards, and they undid it. So I'm just wondering, has there been any effort, or will there be an effort, to put a petition up, to get any kind of organized protests going, or anything that might show the members that, you know, that perhaps they misjudged the community sentiment on this one as well?
Yes, we have. Oh, go ahead, Gene.
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up because I thought we were going to be, for me, the reason I wanted to be here today and share in this Zoom, I consider Janet as somebody that's highly regarded in the community. She has put in countless hours of her time to make this a better community. And she sent emails. She made phone calls.
I was going to ask who you reached out to and what response, if any, you got.
And she's been blanketly ignored by the mayor of La Mesa.
Mark Rabasanos.
That's correct. And city councilman Parent, who happens to be running for the 79th.
Yeah, Colin Parent for the assembly.
Assembly, yes. And it seems kind of a strange mix there, that someone that wants us to give him our vote, but in a circumstance where, I need to talk to you, assembly member Parent. Well, he's ignoring Janet at the level of city council.
It's troubling. Someone's running for higher office and yet is fine with taking away the public's voice in at least this aspect. So, Janet, you reached out to those two. Did you try any other council members or staff or the city attorney or city manager, anyone else to raise
yeah,
points?
Pretty much all of the above. And not just me, but a number of community members have reached out. We put out a flyer explaining the situation, explaining the rationale why we would like to keep remote comments for, you know, community engagement in particular, but we gave them information about who they can contact, what the email, voicemail contacts were for people. And I guess what's really frustrating is that they go into a black hole. And one of my friends who sent messages to all the city council noticed on his email that they were opened by four of the city council members, and the mayor actually deleted it before reading it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Goodness. So yeah. That's really discouraging to think that that might be happening to all of us. We don't know, because he had that particular type of email where he could check to see if somebody opened it or not. And I don't. And many of us do not have that access. But that's pretty frustrating to think that our community engagement is all for naught if the city leaders aren't even paying attention to us.
Yeah, that is.
And it limits our access, because we don't know when we send them a message to a particular council member or to all the city council, and they're not going to read it during publicly. And we don't know if they, as individuals, have read it or not. And it just makes you feel like, well, what kind of engagement do we have access to?
So how many folks are going to show up at the next meeting in person? I should ask, in all fairness, is there anyone that you've heard of who is actually on their side and believes banning public comments was a good idea, other than the four council members who voted to do so.
No, in fact, at that February 27th meeting, there were a dozen. There were 12 people that spoke. Mm-hmm. 11 of them wanted to maintain remote access. One of them did not. And she just simply said, you know, it's time to move on. And she was worried that if people can't see your face and see you, then you're more likely to engage in hate speech. So she took it in that direction. But I think there are ways to minimize the impact of hate speech. Yeah. And the city council just needs to look at those ideas.
Yeah. So it's not like there was some overwhelming push by a bunch of people who wanted them to ban it. Right. Even I'm sure many, probably most of us that found the comments that were made very offensive, but you know, you know, as we've seen the ACLU do, they have defended all sorts of speech that some might find offensive.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't want to beat the horse here, but I also know for a fact that the mayor and Colin Parent have been taking private meetings with citizens of La Mesa, and I'm relatively sure that Janet had put in her request before
these were meetings on the same topic, Gene.
Additional topics, but also the same topic.
Interesting.
But why are they ignoring Janet? Are they intimidated by her? Do they
reach out and ask them? I will be doing just that.
Thank you.
But, you know, in the meantime, does this take effect immediately, or does there have to be a second reading before it actually becomes a law in the books?
It was put into place immediately, and the very next board council or city or commission meeting, it went into effect immediately. So the city just took away all options for remote access.
Wow. Have you reached out to get comment from other, you know, civil rights type groups? I'm thinking groups like, the ACLU, or maybe, you know, Shane Harris with his group that's, you know, vocal on trying to keep public access open, or Calaware. You know, even if it isn't illegal to do what they did, because obviously you didn't have remote before COVID, I would think that some of these organizations might want to weigh in and voice an opinion about what the council has done if they believe that it is a bad move to restrict public access in any way, particularly when it was only, you know, an occasion. This only happened once. It's not like they were having every meeting, you know, disrupted for weeks or months at a time. These people may never have come back, you know?
Yeah. So we've reached out to the Disability Rights of California organization, who have also, they themselves have written a letter to the Attorney General of California. And they've asked that remote participation be required in California across the board. And they want a letter from the Attorney General stating that live remote access, Attorney General Bonta, that live remote access is required in the state of California. So that
was interesting. How would they pull that off? Who would that apply for? I'm thinking about rural planning groups that have never figured out how to do Zoom. Oh. And some of them don't even have, you know, reliable internet connectivity where they meet.
I'm not sure. I hadn't thought about all of the options, and I don't know if they have a lengthy letter that they sent to Attorney General Bonta, requesting a statement from him, just asking that they remove barriers to participation, allow remote participation as an essential part of fulfilling that duty.
I guess you could have people call in and put them on speakerphone or something. I mean, there's lots of low tech ways to do that, even for a rural planning group. So interesting.
Exactly. And then we've been following the ACLU and been in communication with them. We even spoke to our assembly state representative, Sarah Jacobs, about it, and asked her
congressional.
Thank you. Our congressional U.S. representative, and then our state assemblywoman, Dr. Akilah Weber, we've reached out to her office as well. So we're hoping to get statements from them recommending that the city of La Mesa restore live remote commenting to their people in the community.
Yeah, excellent ideas. I'll be eager to hear back from you, or from the officials directly once you've gotten some comments out of them. Very interesting idea. And I would actually think it would be of interest to people on both sides of the political aisle, because obviously, those two officials happen to be Democrats, but I would think they're Republicans who they may want, their followers to be able to come into school board meetings and speak their mind about the issues that they care about. A lot of them have been real vocal there. And if this ban stands in La Mesa, I could see the same thing happening other places, where somebody wants to either shut up liberals or shut up conservatives. I mean, it could go beyond hate speech to just any group you don't want to hear from, right? Maybe a planning group that doesn't want to hear from those darn environmentalists or people upset about, some big project or something. It seems like it's kind of a slippery slope to go down once everybody has gotten so accustomed to being able to, share their views and, stay home and stay safe.
Yeah, definitely. So, and just one other comment that we hadn't really touched on was just the response from our city leaders. They have yet to make a public statement about the hate speech, and other than asking the attorney to tell us what's legal and what's not legal. But I think it's really important that the city take a stand and identify who we are, what we stand for, and make that, our civic leader, our mayor, should come out with a very clear statement about the city of La Mesa and who we are and what we stand for. And that has yet to be done. And that's rather frustrating for a number of people in our advocacy group. They'd like to see a very strong statement by our mayor. And when hate speech, if it happens to come back to our city council meeting, he needs to take a stand and have a statement ready to present to those people.
Yeah, good idea, because we certainly don't want to make it sound that by advocating to restore that free speech that you approve of that sort of speech.
Right, exactly.
And I don't think that's too much to expect. He's recently retired, so he's not constantly busy with his theater troupe.
Yeah.
And he's effectively doubled his own salary. So let's get something for that money. Let's have a mayor that'll step up and stand up to hate.
Good point. What advice would you have to members of the public in La Mesa who might be listening to this and might have an opinion about the ban on remote comments that the city council just approved?
We put together a little talking point flyer, and on the front it's got a variety of talking points that people may connect with and suggested comments, and on the back it's got the contact information for our city leaders. And we'd like to maybe possibly attach this information to your site, and we have been presenting this on social media. I know Jean's been a great help in getting the word out. I think the bottom line is we want to spread the message that we can't let hate mongers win. They want to remove public comment from regular people like you and I. They want to disrupt civic engagement. And if we're going to allow them to do that and just readily remove public comment, we are giving into their and we're helping them win. We're giving into their efforts and helping them win. So
it's kind of an authoritarian sort of move to ban, to restrict speech.
It totally is. So anyway, that's a flyer we'd like to connect.
Yeah, politically, this applies to both ends of the spectrum. In preserving our First Amendment rights to speak, and being responsible and not abusing them, and that that takes away from both sides of the spectrum, in my opinion.
Yes, yeah. It does. So, folks, if you're listening, we have been speaking with Janet Castaños and Jean Carpenter, big activists in La Mesa, who are speaking out and urging the public to get involved in asking the La Mesa City Council to repeal its ban on people calling in with remote comments during not only city council meetings, but all of La Mesa's boards and commissions, the Environmental Commission, Planning Commission, Police Oversight Board, and others. I'm going to let the two of you have the last word today. What else would you like to say to our audience out there?
I just feel it's really important to know and to spread the word, the importance of civic engagement. And I find it's really important. A lot of people say, oh, I just don't want to be bothered. But we live in a democracy. We live in a democracy. We need to participate. We need to, you know, have some idea of what's going on. It doesn't mean you have to be as engaged as others, but you do have to have some idea of what's happening in your community and have a voice. And if you sit back and complain about what's going on, you're not participating as in the democratic process as fully as you should be. You need to be engaged. You need to have a voice. And any ways or means of increasing your civic engagement is really important. And so we need to encourage that.
Jean?
Just speak out.
From you. You get the last word.
I think the thing that I want to say is that we have people in La Mesa that are afraid to get into leadership positions like city council, and not necessarily afraid, but it's not always easy. And I acknowledge that the current city council sometimes has to really wrestle with some things, and it's not easy decisions. Mm-hmm. And that's why I hope that Janet Castaños at some point decides to run for office in La Mesa. I think it would be awesome if she could and would.
Well, there you go. And I do want to say the council isn't here. So, you know, in their defense, you know, it's probably worth noting that anti-Semitism has been on the rise nationally, including crimes of violence. And this is all coming against the backdrop of, you know, just within the last month, a shooting of a Jewish dentist at a dental clinic in El Cajon, which is being investigated, I understand, as a possible hate crime. You know, they don't know yet. So I'm sure, you know, those concerns were probably in the back of their mind, but you know, you have to balance the need to protect any one minority from offensive speech against the rights of, you know, of everyone, all of us, you know, including maybe Jewish people who may want to speak out and speak their mind to the council. When we silence one group, we're really taking away the rights of everyone to free speech under the Constitution and to transparency and full access to our public officials. So I want to thank you both for caring and sharing and taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.